We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on bluechipspeakersnapa.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker tonight, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them, too. I must have this thing. Program is a program of anonymity, and so when I saw who was speaking, I thought, oh, I don't know who Kristen is. And of course, I get here and I realize I do know who Kristen is, and I'm glad to hear her speak. I've seen her at the Fifth Tradition Group, and I've heard her speak there, and I know she works a very good program. I see a lot of her friends here on the front row for her tonight, and with that, I'm going to give you Kristen. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Kristen, and I am an alcoholic. Hey, everybody. My sobriety date is October 7, 2007, and I debated today whether or not I wanted to tell you guys that I was nervous and that I did do a 15-minute speech type thing when I was newly sober, but I haven't had this experience before, and then I realized that by telling you what I was thinking, I've managed to tell you that, yes, I'm nervous, and this is the first time I've really told my story, and I had to kind of laugh at myself because it's like I'm already kind of managing what you think of me, you know, type thing. But and I know that my life is unmanageable by me, that I need to have a power greater than myself, not just to relieve me of the bondage of, you know, alcoholism, but to guide me in all my affairs, and that's what I can do through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did pick up my last white chip. If I keep doing what I'm doing today, it can be my last white chip on October 7, 2007. I did something different. I really did the program as, you know, as it's laid out with a sponsor, to the point where I can sponsor girls and stay right in the middle, which is where I need to be. Before that, I had picked up numerous white chips. I thought maybe I was one of those people who was incapable, you know. But I had someone point out to me that I am naturally incapable. Naturally means on my own, without God's help. So really is that, you know, I wasn't able to stop drinking on my own after numerous tries, you know, but by getting a higher power through AA and to do these things, I've been able to stay sober. So language there, but what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Short version is that I drank when I didn't want to. I drank at the wrong times. I drank when I made strong resolutions that I would never do this again. You know, what happened was, I think, grace. You know, why was this time different? I don't really know. But, you know, God, I do believe that I had a moment of grace that allowed me to come back in another time and do something different. And what it's like now is that I really do have a very simple but awesome life. You know, people around me got secondhand alcoholism, but now they have like secondhand recovery, and there's a lot of restoration in my life today. So I am the oldest of three. I was born and raised in Southern California, and my mom and dad were great parents. Just wonderful. I mean, I had a childhood that, you know, from looking on the outside, was really ideal. Went to private school, had horses, was involved in charity type things, and the private school and such like that. And just we had what we needed. And we don't know where alcoholism really comes from in our family, because my dad came, his parents came over from Sweden with my dad's brother, and then He was born in Chicago, and they moved to Southern California. His dad died when he was young, and so he pretty much helped his mother and brother along. So really, we knew nothing about his side of the family. And maybe in my story later, I'll go back to that, because he was able, before he died, to find out more about his family. But we have no example of alcoholism, really, except that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and really learned about this disease and some of the things that, you know, what it looks like, his brother, Norman, was what I would call an alcoholic. I never saw him drink, but he was always yellow. He died from this disease. He smelled and stuff like that. So, you know, I didn't get it from my circumstances. It might be something that, you know, I was born with this, you know, abnormal kind of strange mental twist. My mom was born and raised in Virginia, and we went back and forth there to see my cousins and stuff like that. And again, there are no examples of alcohol, really. My mom rarely drank, and my dad would have a cocktail when he'd come home from work. I could see them with their friends. And so we had this, like, extended family. My mom was an airline stewardess. She got married about the same time as the other women. They had kids. We all kind of grew up together. And I can remember, you know, the girls that, you know, having their drinks and stuff and playing bridge, and us kids were all over the place just doing what we wanted to do and everything, and a lot of freedoms and really a lot of fun in growing up. I didn't know it then, but I can see now that I was pretty fear-based from the very get-go. I mean, I don't know what I was afraid of exactly, but it just seemed like when I heard Driven by 100 Forms of Fear, I could really relate to that. I even look back at pictures, and I can see this face that looks like I'm, like, afraid of something, you know? I don't know. It was like, I did get some messages from my mom. We have a very close relationship, but I didn't drink for this reason, but she did tell me from the get-go that that I had a screw loose, that I was willful and wicked, and when you're good, you're very, very good, but when you're bad, you're horrid. And if anybody really knew you, they wouldn't love you. And, you know, it was such a confusing kind of message, because she's also so loving, almost to the point of, I mean, she just overdoes. We're close today. But in growing up, there was a lot of that, and I can remember thinking, what's wrong with me? Even at a young age, what's wrong with me? There's something wrong with me. And I would look in the mirror and say, I can't see it. What's wrong with me? And I think basically what was happening was that she wanted me to do what she wanted me to do, when she wanted to do it, wear what she wanted me to wear and stuff. And I guess I had a kind of a mind of my own, and I would say, I'm not going to wear that if you get it. We had uniforms in private school, and so when you get out and get some of your own little, you know, play clothes, whether 7 or, you know, 12, you know, I wanted to wear what I wanted to wear. And so we would butt heads, and that's when we would butt heads, and I'd be the mental defective and things like that. Also to the point of her saying, Kristen really needs to see a psychiatrist. I was so relieved when the psychiatrist told my dad, Kristen doesn't need to be here, your wife does. And I thought, and my dad and I would get a chuckle over that. And I would say, I think they're right. And he would say, you know, I don't understand her, but I love her. And and that's kind of how we feel about her today, too. But, So she still is just desperately trying to manage my life. But her life is better because I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she's not wondering where I am, and she's not, you know, just in, you know, fear of, you know, a phone call or anything like that. You know, we just don't really realize how much we put our families through, our friends through, whatever like that, but especially the family. I had no idea how selfish and self-centered I was. You know, how we come in and we look at those pages and go, what? Selfish? Self-centered? I don't think so, you know. Because after all, I like to give. I was a candy striper, you know. I mean, there you go. And, you know, doesn't that prove something? But I really do. I learned that, you know, we are sick, that we're not bad, that a lot of us have very generous and loving hearts. You know, we have a disease that covers up all that stuff. It just mucks us up, you know. And until we can get that out and clean up that messy, dirty plate of glass, you know, inside of us and get it all out so that the sunshine of the Spirit can come through us, you know, then, forgot what I was going to say. But, you know, that we do, a lot of us are really pretty cool people, you know, and I meet so many different people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and even though I'm nervous and, you know, and things like that, and this is my first time, I'm considering it an adventure instead of like a, you know, it's okay, what are we going to do today? I asked God to relieve me of the bondage of self, and I couldn't even think about what I was going to say, and so I just thought, you know, thank you, God, because you answered my prayers. I could not give this a thought. He has a good sense of humor, you know, type thing. But anyways, we do have, you know, big loving hearts and a lot of times. And, you know, this disease just kills us emotionally, spiritually, and physically. So as I was growing up with really a lot of fun and adventure is what I remember, I was a hard worker. I wasn't very good at school. In fact, school terrified me. And I would be like, you're smart, but you're not living up to your potential and things like that. So, you know, there were a lot of messages in growing up that I was different, that there was something wrong with me. And that would just haunt me. And I would feel so separated from my family sometimes. I have a sister after me and then a brother. So it's Chris and Julie Richard. And I just felt like everything was so great and they had it all, you know. And then there was Kristen, you know. And I was a very vivacious, curious child. They used to call me Curious George, and very fun, loving, and curious. And I was kind of the life of the party, you know. I really love people, and I learned this disease is, like, this is the only disease that's treated by people. You know, recovery begins when one alcoholic talks to another, you know, and that's my experience. And I'm so glad that, you know, that it is a disease treated by people, because I'm not alone. And just the adventure of just meeting, you know, so many different types of people is really neat, and we can be comfortable at really anywhere we go in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. We would have these terrible fights, and so when I was growing up, as fun as it was, there were times when I just felt like so alone or so bad, and I wouldn't know why I was bad. And my first escape was climbing trees. Now, at 7 or 8, there's no alcohol to turn to. I think that I did kind of hide. It would be in trees, and I would be outside looking in. I can see now that I was quite the self-pity, maybe the martyr, because I'd be up in the trees thinking, well, they're all down there and everything like that, and here I am. And I would look, and I'd feel like a third party looking at my family. Like I was just totally disassociated, you know. You know, where did I fit in? I think it was kind of, I don't know, grandiose to think like there's a song in Oliver that says, where is love? And I used to sing that, you know, where is love? Does it fall from skies above? And, you know, like, how am I so unloved? And, you know, and what's so wrong with me? And everything like that. But, you know, nobody would know that, because I would come down off my tree and, you know, and I would be happy. And all those things. And I don't think that was much of an act. I think I was genuinely happy most of the time. So books came up too. So trees and books. And then I mentioned horses in the beginning. And we did have horses. I know that I was a really good worker. I didn't, like I said, I didn't do well in school. It was a private school, and there was a lot of English and stuff like that, not much in biology or algebra, which came in kind of hurt me later on. But I went to the private school, and the horses and things like that is that I would work really hard and pull weeds and shovel manure and clean houses to get the things that I wanted. We had horses, but I wanted that horse, you know, the one that was across the fence, and I would work really hard, and I could buy my own horse, and then I could buy my own car, and my dad really instilled in me that, you know, you work hard and you get and save money and be responsible in that way. Now, that all went out the window as I started my drinking and drugging career. Yeah. My dad was my best friend, that's for sure, and he gave me that sense of security and that something that everything was okay, and he didn't tell me what to do. He just asked questions so that I could find my own answers, you know, and I really like that, and I try to bring that into my sponsoring today. But I would, do those things. So I had the books and the trees, and now we had horses, and I would just get on my horse and ride. And there was a lot of just running. And it was I would be so angry and hurt and things, and just Moonlight and I would just run, you know, and that would be relief. And I can see that there was lots of times in my life before I even picked up a drink where I sought relief. So when I went to, I hadn't had a drink up to this point or anything like that. We did have this wish, my friends and I, as I said, there were families that were all having children about the same time. We were the Olanders, and everybody else around us, you know, would come in, and it was like a big family, type of thing. And a couple of them, my friend Tamara especially, we just couldn't wait until we would get the glass of champagne when we were 13. We would have our own table at Thanksgiving, and we ended up really looking forward to this, you know, mature adult time at Thanksgiving. We weren't at the children's table anymore. We had a table of our own. And we bought special nightgowns, and we twirled around, and we drank our champagne just like we saw our parents do, but, you know, as a childlike thing, you know, just dancing around and just thinking like, oh, this, we're so mature, and this is so much fun, and everything like that. And it really was a really fun time. So my first drink, all I know is that it was fun. After my first drink, then I didn't have the desire to drink that I can remember. I didn't go right into alcohol at that point. That was when I was about 12 or 13. But I did end up going from private school to a public school. And as excited as I was, you know, I was so good at putting on the front and then just feeling so, you know, less than and different. And, you know, people would say nice things, and I'd go, oh, no, and they'd say, you take all the fun out of paying a compliment, you know, just why can't you just say thank you, you know? I was just really just riddled with, just self, really, with self. And I went to high school, and I met a girl who introduced me to alcohol and pot. And I think that I was alcoholic from the gate. Not that first drink in the 13, you know, just wasn't a thought to go drinking. But when she introduced me to some things, I mean, I felt like, I mean, the fear just went away. The fear just went away. And even at the beginning, though, I would drink more than I intended to drink. And the first drunk I had was with this friend, Tamara. And all I remember is us doing the shots of tequila with the lime and all that stuff. She got violently sick, and I laughed hysterically, you know, as I was cleaning up her vomit and stuff like that and everything, and just thinking this is just the funniest thing. And I just loved it. I mean, I just loved it. That it was like a freedom, You know, and like Bill says, it's like a boomerang that you know, turns and cuts us, because it was a freedom, but, it, you know, through the years it became such bondage. I can still feel that every time I thought about drinking or actually did take a drink, I was like chained. You know, I was just chained and bound to this. I was a slave to it, you know, really, like it says in the big book. So through high school, my drinking is abnormal. As I said, like from the get-go, I started drinking too much. We would get beer. My junior and senior year, we drank sometimes at school. We would leave and go get drunk and things like that. And, I mean, people just don't really do that. And I don't know, I didn't really think it was so wrong, but I'm starting to have some consequences even at that time. It could have been in test scores. It could have been not showing up for class because I was too afraid now that I have alcohol on my breath. And, you know, it just seemed all such this adventure of high school, you know, and everybody else was doing it and everything too. So I didn't really see any problems with it. Except that, you know, in looking back, I did things that that jeopardized myself, like driving drunk, leaving school and skipping classes and things, you know, and getting in trouble and coming into the principal's office. And I'm not going to tell him that I was drinking or anything like that. But when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous the first time when I was 21, I could remember that I do fit in here because I was drinking, you know, abnormally. And I could pinpoint back, like, when I would drink before class or stealing liquor, you know, and all those kinds of things. So through high school, there was quite a bit of partying. And I just felt like I had to have something in me. And as much as I like people, I'm not really afraid. I don't need it as a social lubricant. I always felt that, you know, you had to have it for whether it was for a game or a prom or something. You just had to have your drugs and alcohol. You know, I mean, it was like primary. That was the first things first. Okay, we got to make sure we have all our stuff. And I had friends who could supply that. You know, because it scared me to try to get it myself. But they took care of that, and when I graduated, but you know, it took away, the alcohol really took away my kind of my interest in life. I think I just didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was already feeling at this time like something was wrong with me, that my drinking was abnormal. Why are my parents so upset with me all the time? You know, I realize now that, I mean, they're just worried sick when I'm supposed to be home at 11 and I'm not home until 1 o'clock in the morning driving, trying to sneak into the house. And they're like, Kristen, are you home? And I'm just like, you know, just not wanting to see them at all because I was late and I was drunk and I was ashamed. You know, I was just really ashamed. You know, that I was doing these things. You know, I was already crossing a couple lines there, you know, because the last thing I wanted to do was hurt my family. You know, the last thing I wanted to do was hurt somebody out there on the road drinking and driving, and yet there was a part of me that just didn't really care, you know, because once the thought of a drink comes up, if I don't have a solution, if I don't have another action, another thought, and you know, just anything, then it just becomes that obsession, you know. And then I drink. So anyways, I just had an inkling that there were problems with that, with the alcohol. When I graduated, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I'd been working. Work was like my freedom. So at 15, I was earning some money so I could buy my car and Miller's Outpost jeans and things. So I had a lot of independence and things when I was in my last year of high school, but I really didn't know what I wanted to do. And I kind of just said, well, how about working with crippled, you know, with special needs? Because I'd been doing that through National Charity League. And, you know, if my lifestyle, I think, kept me out of the drugs and alcohol. If I was in another situation where drugs and alcohol were available, I probably would have, you know, a pretty rough story up until now, because, you know, from the get, like I said, from the get-go, I think I was alcoholic, and when, if I put it in, I wanted more, and then it became a thought, you know, that was just like, you know, like you couldn't wait to get out of school to drink and things. But I thought, well, that's what I can do, and so I went up to Santa Cruz, California, and in Santa Cruz, I was introduced to some other things, and I started really partying with everybody. My school grades just went way down. I was waitressing, and I found that we would drink champagne, and then sometimes we'd do our tips out, and they would drink, the servers would drink wine and stuff at the bar. And I was like, God, if I have two glasses of wine, I'm going to need to go to the liquor store. But I was at that liquor store last night, so I'd have to go to the liquor store all the way up there. And if I have two glasses of wine here, then what if I get caught? You know, these different things. And so it went from not drinking, because I knew I would want to drink more, to drinking a couple, to now then I'm telling them that I need to take a bottle home for the people who are coming over tomorrow, you know. I really lied about, you know, what I was doing, and just fabricating so many different things to cover up my alcoholism. But I turned 21, and I drove home from the crow's nest drunk, and I got pulled over. So my consequences were basically family type stuff and grades and things, but I was kind of picking myself back up and going to be, you know, a special ed teacher or something like that. But there were other plans for me. I did get pulled over. I got a reckless driving. 2 weeks later, I got another one, and I called up my dad, and I said, you know, this place is just destructive. You know, Santa Cruz and everything. I need to have something constructive. After all, my mom always said, if you have a hobby, if you really are busy and stuff like that, then you won't want to drink. You know, you got to have that. You know, they tried all they could to help me, but their solutions weren't solutions that works for an alcoholic like me. I could be busy, but I still had the disease of alcoholism. So I went back down south to L.A. and fear sobered me for a bit. Just like in Bill's story, he says, you know, fear sobered me for a bit. And it did. I was so afraid of drinking that I would pick up a drink and that I wouldn't be able to stop. I knew that, and I felt like maybe I was an alcoholic because I'd read some things on it. And then when I got the DUI and the reckless driving, they said go to AA. And I went to AA. And you know what? I loved AA that first time I walked in. I was 21 years old. And I walk in and there's a bunch of women. And I saw God on the wall. And I thought that was great because I consider myself a Christian. You know, I have a... I've always believed in God, just always. I've never questioned anything. We weren't a really particularly religious family, but I did believe in God, and I had some examples of having a relationship with God through my grandmothers, especially, and what that meant. But I saw all that, and I thought, wow, you know, this is really, really cool, but I'm not 40, divorced, and smoking. So, you know, as fun as this is, I'm going to come, you know, for the once a week that I need to. And then because it's such a neat group of women, I'm going to go back, you know. And at that time, all I could hear was that when I pick up a drink, I get drunk. So don't drink. You know, go to a lot of meetings and things like that. I mean, it took years and years and years until I realized, you know, through the help of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people that God put in my life, that I have a mental aspect to this disease. So I went to that meeting for quite a while. I didn't do any steps or anything like that. I just stayed, like I said, sober because of my job and things like that. You know, I hadn't quite crossed that line where I was making, where it was really interfering, which is what happens later. So, you know, what it was like was that over the next, you know, I don't know. So when all that was over and everything like that, I didn't go back. I did stay in AA, realizing that maybe there is something to this. Maybe I really do have a problem. And I did get a sponsor, and I did work the steps, and we did a lot of 12-stepping. We did a lot of picking gals up out of their apartments. And I would just look at it, and I would just say, this will never, ever be me. Not that I'm so special, but I couldn't imagine that I could ever be like that, that would ever happen to me. And I got really close to that, you know, to that, just not, this disease is just horrific. This is definitely a life and death situation. And I would see people just basically dying of alcoholism and just thinking, that will never be me, you know. But I really did the thing, but I got a job that started traveling all over the country and things like that. And so, really, I'm only not drinking because I'm going to some meetings and because I'm so afraid that if I pick up a drink, I'll get drunk. And I was in a very male-dominant business, and I was not going to be the blonde bimbo up front training 50 men on Texas Instruments to Commodore computers, you know. So there, my pride was there. I'm going to be sharp at 7 a.m., you know, and I didn't want to go out drinking with everybody because then I knew that I would have to get a bottle up in my room, and then the next day I'd be a mess. And so, you know, that lasted for a little while. I was able to not drink for about 2 years based on that system. And I don't remember being particularly miserable. I really, really got into my job, and I started traveling around the country and things like that. And I don't really even know what happened, why I picked up that first drink, but I did. And I think that I was feeling kind of lonely and overwhelmed and things, and I thought, I didn't really think. A drink came my way, and I picked it up, and after that, I started drinking on all my business trips. I mean, I would fly in and out of airports, you know, and just drink and drink and drink and get lost and try to say that it was because of my traveling, that I would have to drink to be on that time zone so I could go to sleep, and, you know, a lot of rationalizing and everything like that. Gosh, time goes fast. So anyways, I started drinking again. And what happened over, like, the next 20 years, you guys, is just, I don't understand it, but I went in and out of these rooms. And I loved AA, and I didn't think, but, you know, and I don't know why I couldn't really get this thing except for that. I mean, I do and I don't. I would say, yes, I'm powerless, and my life is unmanageable. Came to believe, I already believe, so I'm kind of already there. You know, a lot of people don't, so I've got one, you know, I've got, you know, a good stronghold here, a foothold here, and turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Well, I already do that, you know, so I was always doing the 1, 2, 3, the 1, 2, 3. I never did the 4th and 5th, which is, you guys, you just got to do it. It's not scary. It just gets rid of all that yuck, you know, and I wasn't afraid to do a 4 and 5. I just didn't think I needed it. And, you know, for years I went just on knowledge, self-will, you know, just leaning on other things so that I wouldn't drink. And I did this for years, going in and out of AA, picking up white chips and just not getting this thing. I moved from California to here, and I did not get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, you know, if anybody's going to move or go out of town or something, jump right into Alcoholics Anonymous, get connected. You know, So I continued, you know, for those 20 years, I just kept drinking. And when I got married, my husband would say, "Kristen, it's a matter of willpower. Just stop drinking." But he wanted a drinking wife. So, you know, we just had this weird relationship of you can't drink, but when we have friends over, get the alcohol. And that's when I started, you know, and that just led to sneaking out alcohol and all that kind of stuff, just sneaking it on the ride home, going in and out of treatment centers, and, you know, doing the 30 days. When you come home, it's business as usual. Take care of the kids and do that stuff. And so, really, my husband was my higher power. You know, I mean, he pretty much ran the show, and I let him. And when I moved here, I just didn't get involved. And, you know, what it ended up was that I was a stay-at-home mom, drinking out of the closet, just crying because I did not want to drink. And yet I was not able to not drink. I was drinking and driving. My children were finding the alcohol in my trunk. They were following me into Kroger. Gas stations, I would try to get beer and put something in my, you know, trunk for just in case. Well, it was never, you know, I'm going to drink it. You know, you just what, you know, once I started drinking, I would do anything. I mean, you know, I realized today, and I didn't see it then, just how I jeopardized everybody. You know, thank God nothing happened to them. But something did happen to them. Eventually, after several treatment centers, I got served papers in treatment. So this disease, you know, took away my family and everything. And you know, part of me was kind of relieved because I thought maybe I'll get sober this time. But, you know, it's really a horrible feeling to be looking at my children and realizing that I'm choosing to drink over them. I am past human aid when I am saying I'm not going to drink for the children and yet still drinking. Stole their security and their trust and stuff like that through a divorce, and their dad had to get nannies, and it was not an ideal childhood for them. After a point, there were several years there that were just awful. But I did get serious. I woke up one morning. I was practically homeless, and I woke up, and all I could think of was that I am an alcoholic. Nothing, absolutely nothing can keep me sober. Forget the hypnosis. It's not going to work. That's where I was kind of going to next. It's not going to work. And God, you know my heart. Why won't you fix me? Why won't you fix me, you know? I've learned today that my God gave me a way out through Alcoholics Anonymous, that he's still the same God I had, but now I understand myself, what my alcoholism is. And I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did something different. I surrendered, and I started going to meetings, and I went to meetings every night. People and I got into like a three-quarter house, and I started working at a Starbucks, and I took baby steps in sobriety. I had never really gotten a sponsor, or the sponsor was just the name only and call a little bit. My sponsor is one of the most key components of my sobriety today. I am not an alcoholic who can mess around and make up my own concoction. I have to have a program of recovery in the steps. I need to be at meetings. I want to be at meetings. I love meetings. I need to pray. I need to enlarge my spiritual life. You know, I need to reach out. My relief is that whenever something's going wrong or something like that, my relief is you. You know, it's God and you. Stop, pause, ask God for help, and turn your thoughts towards others. You know, all these things that I'm learning in AA, I'm starting to apply throughout my life. And having a sponsor, it teaches me that, you know, between here and God, I'm still self-interpreting. And how can I possibly know what I really have? Because I'm you know, using my own mind to fix myself or to understand myself and everything. So, and that doesn't work. So with a sponsor, I can see my disease in action, as far as like when I'm being selfish and self-seeking, just the different things like the fear and all the different things that go in my head. You know, I'm over-managing my life right now, and it's just like, beep, you know, and I can see myself doing it. But I really took hold of this thing and got involved and got a home group. Another thing, everybody is, you know, a sponsor, a home group. I mean, I think the only reason I'm standing here today is because I did get the gift of desperation, and I did become willing to do whatever it takes. And what it takes is not hard. I never really balked at it. I guess I just thought that somehow I could fix myself, you know, and that would be between God and I. And I didn't really get angry at God, but I was like, why can't you fix me? You know my heart. You know my heart and everything. And, you know, and I did have a moment of clarity when I woke up at 3:30 in the morning, just realizing that, oh, my God, I have destroyed the life of everybody around me. I am one of those girls that I saw 10, 12, 15, you know, years ago. I was hopeless. That's what it is, clear and simple. I was hopeless, and I was terrified of what I was going to, you know, what this really meant. And what it meant was that I was very sick. I needed a solution, and you know, and that gift of desperation got me into the rooms and really doing this. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. The steps and the principles and all those things are things that I can take into my everyday. I mean, I do use the prayers in the book. I mentioned the stop, pause, and ask God for help. There's the fear prayer. You know, I don't struggle with wanting a drink today or a drug. That's not my thing. It really is life. And the way that I live my life and manage my life without you, without the program, without a sponsor and all that stuff, will take me to a drink. I can't even see. I believe my alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful, and it's going to disguise itself, and it's going to seem like the right thing to do, or all these different things, you know, and it isn't. I need to run it by somebody, and I need to, like I said, use these principles. I mean, what's my motive? That's another one. What's my motive? It's not just when I walk into a bar or a party, what's my motive? What's my motive in everything? You know, what am I giving to God? You know, am I really giving him my will and my, that which means my thinking, you know, or am I just going through the exercise of reading some things in the morning? I am diligent with this program. I mean, I'm not perfect at this, you know, doing it perfectly every day, but really almost every day. I heard somebody in Birmingham years and years ago say, every day I wake up, I'm an untreated alcoholic. And finally that made sense to me. And I do believe in just the depths of my soul, because I've seen it, is that this is a life and death situation. And they talk about the grave nature of alcoholism. It is grave. It kills, and you can't even see it coming sometimes, you know. I have to be very careful of my thoughts and how I do things and things. But, you know, the promises do come true. There is a intuitiveness. I love taking things to my sponsor today because I learn things, you know. A couple of years into my sobriety, I had kind of a thing of like, what's going on with me? Something's not really right. And, you know, I asked God. I really believe that I have a best friend and companion in my higher power. I'm not lonely. I do not need a hobby anymore for my down days, you know, type thing. I can be with myself. I have wonderful women in my life as well. But I do have a skill set, but I still need my sponsor. And it's really cool when I'll call her with something and she'll go, I was just talking to my sponsor about that yesterday, and just how all these things happen. And just and in sponsoring girls too, we're right there learning, just in, I don't know, keeping it fresh, seeing other people get it, seeing people's lives just change and blossom and grow. And at that time when that happened, I needed to enlarge my spiritual life, and I said, who and how? And he showed me, You know, and I've listened very carefully to the God of my understanding. He's put several sponsors in my path that gave me exactly what I needed when I needed it. There were times when I needed to take the risk of changing a sponsor, you know, but I kept it all bridged, you know, from sponsor to sponsor or, you know, a home group. You know, don't get a new home group until, don't leave the home group until I have a new one. You know, I just really have to stay close. And I'm getting married. I met somebody in the program. We took it really slow for about 2 years and just were friends. And we started off with God, AA, family, job, and then relationship. Anything I put before my sobriety, I know I will lose because that's my experience. I just lost so much, but I've also regained so much through this program. My kids love and they just love me. We have so much fun. I'm just like a child around them sometimes. It's like, yeah, it's just I can be really goofy. I can embarrass them, but they love it anyways. And they don't follow me into Kroger anymore. They just say, drop us off, Mom. We're not going. And we laugh, and we laugh, and we laugh, and we laugh. And, you know, my life is really, really simple. And when Eric and I met, we just made sure that we just really focused on our sobriety. We have different home groups. We work two different programs, and yet we can come together and go to some meetings together and stuff. And it is a very big part of my life. But I truly believe if this isn't first, there is no second. As long as I keep this first and I do this, and I do almost everything every day, I am relieved of the bondage of alcoholism. I can see when I'm in the bondage of self, and I have actions to take me out of that, and that it has just given me a wonderful, wonderful way to live, and the relationships are stored, and I don't know. One of the biggest gifts is that I'm not afraid today. To wake up and be happy and not afraid, I mean, how great is that? I thought, how am I ever going to wake up in the morning and not be afraid? You know, I was afraid of being afraid type thing, but I don't have to live that way today, and nobody else has to live that way today, you know? If you're new or if you're in here for a while and you don't have a sponsor, get one because, like I said, life and death, and do the steps and reach out and help people. Even if you're not at a sponsoring stage, look for the newcomer, you know? Shake hands with the newcomer, introduce yourself. Do something. Just do something different than what we were doing before. And with that, I'll be picking up my 6-year chip October 7th, and that is a miracle, just a miracle. So thank you for listening.
Thank you so much. You did a great job. Really a great story. Thank you for sharing with us.